And I want to thank Marilyn and the committee for asking me to share with you today. And I also want to tell you, you know, I've been in California for a number of years now, and I've never been able to visit Monterey. And God, it's just beautiful here, and the warmth and the love and the fellowship that I felt from my first hour in here with you has just been tremendous, and I wanted to tell you that before I get started here. I am very proud to stand here before you this morning to tell you that I am a sober woman member of Alcoholics Anonymous. This wasn't the case a little over 23 years ago. I was in a mental institution at the time at UCLA. And we had one woman on our ward who was being treated for a thing called alcoholism. I had no idea what that was. I'd never heard that terminology before. And I had been out on a little excursion that day. For any of you who have been in the, pardon the expression, the nut houses, you know that when you behave yourself, they let you go out on little excursions occasionally. And I had been let out that day, and we were aboard a fishing boat. And they were serving beer aboard it, and everybody else seemed to be drinking, so I did too. And needless to say, by the time we got back that evening, I was drunk, real drunk. And they kept me downstairs for a little while to get me sober before taking me upstairs. And this woman came into my room and said to me, "Beverly, I think you're an alcoholic." Well, I've never been so insulted in my life. And I told her in no uncertain terms that she needn't lay her thing on me. By God, I was crazy. And you know, the sad part of it was is that I really meant it. I really did. I grew up in a little town in Florida, West Palm Beach, because I know people are going to say, "Where at in Florida?" West Palm Beach. And when I was young, Daddy had told us kids, can't remember the occasion. I had two older brothers, and I had two older boy cousins that lived next door. And coming from a little town, you don't have a great deal of playmates to play with, and that's the reason it's so important. And for some reason or other, the discussion had come up, and I can't remember what it was, but Daddy had said to us kids, he says, "When you're old enough to go to work and buy your own cigarettes and your own booze, as far as I'm concerned, you're old enough to smoke and drink." Well, hell, needless to say, I went to work at an early age, you know. Now, the real reason for that was is that the war came along. And for any of you young people here, that was the Second World War, not the first one. Get that one straight right off. And I went to work at the age of 13. Now, part of the reason why I went to work so early also was the fact my mother, I got to tell you about Mama, she was very important in my life. And I know that a lot of women that come into this program have a lot of emotional problems, if you will, in their relationships with their mother. And I was very fortunate. My mother and I were extremely close. But Mother, you know, when we go into meetings, we see a lot of these cliches around the walls. Well, I knew about cliches when I got here because my mama used to have them. And one of her cliches was, "Idle hands are hands of the devil." And some of my little girlfriends were getting pregnant about that time. And somebody's idle hands were involved. So Mama put me to work, thinking she'd keep me out of mischief for a little while. And it worked for a little while. I started drinking at that age. Now, it seemed like when the war came along that the whole world just went on a big party. And I just joined the party. You know, it was, I thought no more of walking in and ordering a drink than I would have thought of ordering a Coca-Cola at the corner drugstore. And that was the way I started. Now, by the time I was 16, I was a blackout drinker. Also, at that age, I was pregnant and married, just in that order. Now, today, hell, if you got to get married, you know, being pregnant's as good a reason as any. But at that time, it was really frowned upon. Nice girls didn't do that. And You got to remember, I said that I was a blackout drinker. Would you believe that I was almost 4 months pregnant before I even knew I'd been had? God's truth. I spent a lot of time throwing up, and I went to the doctor, and he said to me, "Beverly, you're pregnant." And I said, "But I can't be. I've never been with a man." I was second Virgin Mary. He assured me that I'd been had. Now, I want you to know I've since found out what did that, and I've made up for it. But anyway, I did marry this man, and I lost that first child. But there are two things in that marriage that I want to tell you about because they were extremely important in my drinking years and also in my sobriety years. And during the time we were married, you know, there was a little something the matter with me during the years that I was married to him. Now, I would like to say, that it was just normal for me, but I remember that I was also drinking, from the time I was 13. But a little off because this man stood, about 5'11". And I stood about 5'4½", and he weighed about 175 pounds, and I weighed about 98. And I wasn't drinking at this period in my life because I didn't have any money to drink with, and he never took me with him anymore. But when he would swing at me, which he did, if you've been in those kind of marriages, I'd stand up and swing back, sober. So there had to be a little something wrong with me even then. But this one night, he walked into the house, and for whatever reason, he struck me across the mouth with a full bottle of beer. Now, I was spitting teeth and blood, and I was sober at this time. And the next thing I remembered is I was on my knees in front of the bedroom door, and I had the black stub of a handle of a butcher knife in my hand with just a little piece of that knife still on that handle. And I looked up the door, and there were two parts of that knife in the door. Thank God he was behind it, I think. But what happened was, without even knowing it at the time, I made a commitment. It frightened me so bad that I would never, ever get angry again. Because, you see, getting angry meant I might kill somebody. So I began to bury anger. Now, when I left him, I had had another child by then. As I said, I lost the first one, and I had another child. And I left him when that child was 6 weeks old. Now, the reason I did is because the doctor had told me he was an habitual drunkard. You see, they didn't use the terminology alcoholic or alcoholism. I don't think they... Maybe they did. My doctor didn't, anyway, at that time. And he said, he's going to get worse. He's not going to get better. And because I didn't want my... Understand this. I didn't want my child raised in that kind of an atmosphere with a drunken father. I left him. And I did what we in Alcoholics Anonymous call a geographic. I came from Florida out here to California. Now, in other circles, that's known as unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. But anyway, I got out here to California, and I did what I called return to social drinking. And a normal life. Now, my mother was out here, and she had sent me the ticket to come out here on. And there was another thing that happened as a result of that marriage. I spent several years after leaving that man rocking, crying, cussing, and praying. Because, you see, I thought I still loved him. And I vowed again, without recognizing what I was doing, that I would never, ever love anybody that much again. Because, you see, loving somebody hurt too much. So I didn't ever want to love. So by the time I was very young, 22, 23 years old, I was bearing two of the strongest emotions that a human being can have. Now, my mother had another cliche. She had lots of them. But anyway, I had left him when she was 6 weeks old, and time had gone by. Now, I learned lessons slow, but I learned them well, and the one thing I had learned out of that marriage is you don't go to bed with them first. You get married. And by this time, my child was about 4 years old. Well, I want to tell you, it had been a long, dry summer. I decided that she needed a father and I needed a husband. And so I met this young Irish Catholic boy. Now, Betty told you, hell, we all know that all Irish Catholics are alcoholics. They're all here, you know. Would you believe I married the only Irish Catholic that didn't drink? I didn't know there was such a person. He didn't drink. Now, I got to tell you, by the time I married him, I was in the throes of alcoholism. And he interfered with my drinking. He didn't like it when I drank. One of them had to go. We know which one it was. Well, Mom and I were back together again by this time, and as I said, Mama had another cliche, is if you don't succeed at first, try again. And she was just coming out of her fourth marriage when I was coming out of my second one. We had gotten home from work one night, and I just put the baby to bed. Mama looked over at me, and she said, you know, honey, she said, we ought to get us some kind of business to ensure Charlotte, my daughter, a more secure future. Well, hell, that sounded like a good idea to me, and I had a little bit of cash. Mama had a AAA credit rating, so we bought a business, a liquor store. Now, what I haven't told you is Mama was an alky. The fun began. I was already into morning drinking by this time. And it was working just fine for me because I was a moving drunk. And, of course, we had the liquor store, I had the home, and the baby to take care of, and I also had a lunch job on top of this. And so I had to keep moving, and the morning drink was the only thing that would get me well enough, you know, to keep going every day. And along about this time, I fell in love again. What I really did was fall in heat. I didn't know that then. But anyway, I was introduced by this time because my morning drink was getting where it wasn't working for me anymore, because what I was doing now was going from sick to drunk again. And I found the barley sandwich. Now, for those of you who don't know what the barley sandwich is beer and tomato juice. I got my booze and my vitamins at the same time. Doesn't sound good. Didn't taste good either. But you see, it worked. And I didn't give a damn how it tasted. It was the effect I was after. I needed something to work for me so I could keep moving and keep going. Because by this time in my life, alcohol was the only consistent thing I had. It was the thing that stabilized me, that kept me moving. And I needed it. Now, this worked for another couple of years. And then I began to have little symptoms. First little symptom I had, I was making the bed one morning. And it was wet. Now, if it had been wet underneath, I could have understood it, but it was wet on top of the bedspread. And I didn't know where that had come from, but I didn't have time to think about it. You got to remember, I was a moving drunk, and I was on my way to work, and I went on into the bathroom to get dressed for work, and I looked in the mirror, and it was like somebody had turned on two water faucets. I wasn't crying. The water was just pouring down my face. But I didn't have time to think about it. And we know what fixes it if anything's wrong. I went and had a couple double hookers, and hell, I was fine. And I went on to work. Now, the next thing that began to happen was I had gotten home from work one afternoon, and the pit of my stomach started shaking. I could feel it right in the gut. And I thought, damn, you know, and it scared me. And the next thing I knew, I looked like I was doing the St. Vitus dance, and I was hopping around all over the living room. But we know what fixes that, don't we? Another couple of hookers. Felt great. As soon as I got them down, I went on about my business and fixed dinner. Now, the next symptom that I had was I had laid down one afternoon across the bed. And when I woke up, I was on the floor. And this time, I was scared. I was terrified. And if there's been anything in my life that has ever motivated me, drunk or sober, and that's pain and fear. pain and fear will cause me to move. Now, I went to the doctor, and what they found out was they figured I was in the midst of a nervous breakdown and that I was having epileptic seizures. Hell, they were the doctor. I didn't know any better. But it was through this with how I ended up at UCLA in the NPI section. And I told you what happened out there. Well, when this woman told me that she thought I was an alcoholic, I went to my psychiatrist, and I told him, I said, you know what Lenore said to me, and I told him what she had to say, and he looked over at me, and he said, honey, he says, I don't think so. He said, if you can just learn to face reality. And learn to cope with some of your problems. Can't see where you'd have any problem with alcohol. Hell, he was the doctor. Sounded right to me. So I continued on with my life. But that was the seed planted, you see. That was the first time I had heard the message. And I went on. Now, what happened to me was what happens to many alcoholics, but maybe mine was a little bit different. Maybe it wasn't. That moment of clarity. I was in my home in Chatsworth. Now, I don't know about you, but my story went something like what was written in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous from this point on, from the whole thing, really. I didn't know it then. But I was sitting there in this home this night waiting for this man to come home that I was married to at that time. And he was late getting there. He was due home at 5. I think he needed around 8. And I had waited as long as I could for him to get home. And I decided I just couldn't wait any longer. I had to have a drink. Now, my daughter had gone away to spend the weekend with some friends. And, you know, at this time in my life, I had tried to quit drinking. For the reasons that the book talks about. You know, this man had said to me on several occasions, he said, Beverly, you know, why can't you drink like a lady? Well, hell, I was drinking like a lady. I never fell off of the bar stools. Fell a few times getting up on them, but I never fell off of them, you know. And my mama had said to me a couple of times when she was sober, honey, I think you drink too much. You ought to cut down. And I looked at her and I said, yeah, Mama, I think we both oughta, you know. And then there was my daughter. And I remember many times when she was young. And I'd come in from work and I'd fix that drink. And she'd say to me, Mama, do you have to have it? And I'd look over at her and I'd kind of smile and say, yeah, honey, just this one. You know, I got to get supper ready. Now you go on and go play. And I'm just going to have this one and get dinner ready. And then we'll eat. And she'd say, Mama, do you really have to? You see, she didn't understand. I had to have it. And when she looked at me, there was a lot of love in her eyes and a lot of concern. And as she kept growing older, she'd look at me and she'd say, Mama, do you really have to have that? You've had it happen to you, huh? And that love and concern had turned into one of pure anger and disgust. And you see, if I could have quit drinking, I would have quit drinking for this child, because my dream from the time I was a little girl myself was to get married and to have a husband that loved me and a family and a home. And I had had 14 pregnancies and I only have one living child. And this child meant an awful lot to me. And I couldn't even quit drinking for her. Now this night, I opened this can of beer, trying to cool it. And this man finally come home just as I'd gotten that drink ready, and he walked in and he took a look at me. He finally got there about 8 or 8:30, I think it was. We all know where in hell husbands are when they don't get home. Anyway, he said to me, you're drunk. Well, you know, he had me. I don't care whether he said you're drunk or you're crazy, he had me on both counts. And he said, I'm not taking you anywhere tonight. And with this, he went on up into the bedroom and passed out. He had a little drinking problem, too, I think. Anyway, I remember walking through the house that night. And I stood in the kitchen window, and it faces the front, and I looked out onto the driveway, and there was two new cars sitting out there. And I walked through the house, and it's a beautiful home. And I walked on out into the backyard, and it was well manicured. And if you'd have looked at us as a home and a family, you know, we look like we fit in better homes and gardens someplace. And yet as I stood there and I looked up and I said, why God, why now, when I've got everything that I have always wanted, why do I want to die? You know, and I didn't know the answer to it then, but I can tell you now, what good is all you've got if there is no joy in it? And you know, Christ said something pretty close to that. He was talking about all the things that we have, and there has been no value in them because we've made too much out of them. And you see, I had drank myself into a living hell, into an absolute living hell, and there was nothing I could do. I had lost my soul, you see. I had lost my soul. And I did the only thing that night that I knew to do. You know, if you can't drink any more, and you can't drink any less, and you're caught right in that place, what do? I killed myself. Now, I say that facetiously, but I believe for me that that night I died. If the book be true, and I have found the book always to be true, I don't know about you, but I believe it's on page 63, and it talks about we are reborn. Now, I woke up in a hospital 3.5 days later, and I had tubes running from my mouth, my nose, my arms, even out my ankles. They had tubes. And for the first time in many years, I had no feeling. I was neither glad that I wasn't dead nor glad that I was still alive. I was just void of any feeling. And I went into the psychiatrist. When I was able to get out of there, he sent word that he wanted to see me. Did you know that committing suicide is against the law? I didn't know that. Anyway, this psychiatrist said to me, he said, Beverly, you need help, and you need it desperately. And he said, while you were in the hospital, I went to some open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. He said, I liked what I heard there. I also picked up some of their literature, and I read it, and I liked what I read. And he said, I have their telephone number. Will you call them? And I sat there and I thought about it for a minute. And I told him I would. Because you see, I knew it wasn't going to work because I had tried everything there was. But I had my ace in the hole, you see. When it didn't work, I could always kill myself again. And with this, I went on home. And I made sure that I had my house all spiffy. That was important. What would these people think of me, you know? And I called. And my 12-step call went something like this. On the phone, this woman says to me, do you think you have a drinking problem? She didn't ask me if I was an alcoholic. Well, hell yes, I had a drinking problem, you know. She said, are you drinking now? And I said, no. Can you hang on for a couple of hours and I'll send somebody out to talk to you? And I said, well, I'll try. Anyway, within just a couple hours, these gals came out to my house. And I could hardly wait for them to get there. Because you see, when I told them about that son of a gun that I was married to, they were going to understand why I had to drink like I did. And I had it all ready for them, and they came to the door, and I invited them in. And every time I tried to tell them about him, they would turn around and say, hey, Virginia, do you remember when I told you? And then she'd turn around and say, yeah, Joe, I remember. Do you know that they were there for over 2 hours and I never got to tell them anything about me? But I tell you what they did. When they got ready to leave, they said they were going to go to a meeting that night at 8 o'clock and for me to be ready, and they'd take me, and I was ready, and they came and we went. Now, on the way to the meeting, they said something like this to me. They said, Beverly, don't try to identify with how much, how often people drink. Try to identify with a feeling and what alcohol did to them and see if you can identify with any of these things. And that was what I did. When I came to you people, you told me that you weren't going to tell me whether I was an alcoholic or not. That was going to have to be up to me. So it behooves me to try to find out what an alcoholic was. You see, I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I knew what a drunk was, but I didn't know what an alcoholic was. So I began to try to read this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that you people have offered me. And I talked to my doctor about it, and he knew very little about it. And I talked to my psychiatrist, and he also knew very little about it. So I talked to a lot of you people, and you told me, you know, a lot about what the disease was about. And I decided I had it. You know, in this book, it talks about it a great deal. It says there are three conditions before you can start working on this program. And you hear them read at almost every meeting you go to when they read chapter 5. It says in there, if you have decided, that's condition number one, that you want what we have. Well, what in the hell have we got? We got sobriety, and we got a lot more than that, too. But in the beginning, it was sobriety that I was after. And it goes on to say, and are willing to go to any length to get it. Condition number three. Then you are ready to take certain steps. If you haven't decided that you want what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, you're not going to get it. It's that simple. These are three very important conditions. Now, when I started in this program, I got myself a sponsor. We hear about those. It's one of the first things they tell you to do. And I got one. We were sitting around talking one night, this sponsor and myself, with some other girls. You know, she was one of those kind of sponsors that says, "Thou shall have no other gods before me." And we were having a discussion. We didn't argue. We discussed things. And I can't remember exactly what it was all about, but she said, Beverly, she said, if you got drunk, she said, I want you to know, she said, I'm not responsible for that. I looked at her and I said, well, oh. And she was a little upset with me, and she turned around and she walked away from where I was. And just a second, she turned around, she came back to me, and she said, and by the way, she said, I remember that you're suicidal, and she said, I want you to know that if you decide to commit suicide, I'm not responsible for that either. Well, I looked at her, and I said, well, what the hell are you responsible for then? You know, God, what's a sponsor for? She looked over at me, and she picked up this book, and she says, I'm responsible for helping you to learn what's in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and how to use it and apply it into your daily life. I said, well, oh, I didn't like that. In other words, what she was telling me is that I was going to have to be responsible for my own actions. I thought about that one for a little while, and I thought, well, no problem there. God, I've always worked, and I've always done these things, you know, and I'm a very responsible person. And as I went on with my sobriety, I come to find out that I'd really never been a responsible person, even though I had worked and done a lot of other things. Because, you see, I'd always had a boss. And that boss was always responsible for what I did. Now, at first, it was my mom and my daddy. It was their fault if I didn't turn out right. And then it was my school teachers. It was their fault if I wasn't getting my lessons right. And then it was my employers. And then it was my husband's, whoever he was at the time, that was responsible for my life. Does it sound like I got a little problem running around in here? You better believe it. But I didn't know it then. So anyway, I began to learn a few things about what this program was all about. And here I was now, just a few weeks and months sober, and she was telling me I was going to have to be responsible for my sobriety. Well, that scared me. Again, I was back into pain and fear. Because, you see, I had begun to get a little taste of this program and what it was like to be sober. And I was beginning to get a little self-worth by now. And I was beginning to come out of that living hell I was in. And I didn't want to go back. And again, if there's been two things that have ever motivated me in my life, it has been pain and fear. That'll move me every time. And I was scared. So I got into this book. And I began to study it some more. Now, I got to tell you, too, I don't know how many of you here heard my husband when he spoke up in Sacramento. But this man talked about the big book, and he talked about the first page in the big book. He also said that he had an IQ of 160. Well, I want you to know that my comprehension is below average. Now, it took this man 3 months to learn about the first page that has nothing written on it. He told me, I knew right away what was on the first page. I knew it was blank. Because, you see, I was taught to use my first page as an emergency page. Now, when you see this book, this was my mama's book. My book, I gave it to my ex-father-in-law. He died with it, drunk, but I gave it to him. Anyway, on the first page, I wrote in my book, emergency page in red. Something about red that really attracted me. And when I would go to meetings, and I would hear a woman talk, and I liked what she had to say, I'd go up to her after the meeting, and I'd ask her to put her name and her telephone number in my book. And then on the second page, over on this blank side over here, honey, I also had this an emergency page. And as I would read the book, I don't know about any of y'all, but when I first got here, I'd read that book, you know, and I'd sit there and shake my head, yeah, when I was reading it, because I knew it was right, you know. But by the time I got to the period, I couldn't remember what it said. You identify with that, huh? So what I did was I'd write the page number over here, and then I'd write a little short synopsis beside the page number. Now, the reason I do this, I don't know about y'all, but when I get to flying around and get in trouble and get emotionally upset, I get unbalanced. And I can't think right. And I'd call my sponsor and she'd say, well, it's in the book. Well, hell, you know. But I could remember to go to the first page. And I'd look and I'd see something, you know, there with a page number. Like this secondary problem I had. And I'd go there and I'd look, you know, when I was practicing these principles, and one of the little affairs I was having at the time, you know, and I couldn't. Oh, by this time I was divorced. And anyway, do you know where they talk about sex in this book? Page 69. Would you believe that? Dirty book. You see, I had gone through a divorce by this time. And I recognized that I had a secondary problem after the compulsion of alcohol left. And I didn't know exactly what to do about it. And I was beginning, you know, to learn how to think. You know, the nice thing about being around here for a little while is that you watch people get sober. And as they get sober, you know, you see their face begin to relax. And the light comes into the eyes. And they begin to get so beautiful. And then after they've been here about a year or so, you can see the mind beginning to click. But you know, when we first get here, we're like little kids in a candy store. And, you know, I haven't seen anybody in this program yet, I don't care whether they're 6 or 96, man, woman, or child, who has come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous that has not walked in here with two problems. Bad breath and a broken heart. This a hell of a spiritual meeting. God. Booze and sex, if you will, in plain common everyday language. When we're able to get honest. And I was no different. I was absolutely no different. And I was taught, as most of us was, get a good basic program. A real good basic program. Don't get emotionally involved your first year. And stay away from those dirty old men, honey. Right? Because when we come in here like kids in a candy store. I'll have him, 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 and him. And don't you laugh, because there's a lot of dirty old women around here, too. And you know, you guys were taught the same thing. You know, one of the first things you guys hear, I'm sure, when you come in here, is behind every slip there's a skirt. Right? I see you smiling, honey. But behind every slipper there's a zipper, too, and don't you forget. And I was in trouble. Oh, God, was I in trouble. Now, I had picked up a couple of babies by this time. I was 3 years sober, and I was divorced. And I knew what it was to be a sober married woman here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I did not know what it was to be a sober single woman. And there was a lot of difference. And I began to understand the feeling of walking into a meeting, especially at night, alone. You see, that was okay. But it was when I walked out of those meetings at night alone that the pain was there. And the lonesomeness was God-awful. And I would walk home at night, and I would be in that house. And I remember going to some of these women's stag meetings that I were going to, and I was telling them about this loneliness and how I hurt and how painful it was. And they would tell me to go to the source. And when I would get home at night, I would wrap my arms around myself and I would say, God is with me and I am not alone. But it was terrible. I don't want to ever forget that. Because I want you to know that I know what it was like. I was afraid, because here I was now single and sober, and I was 39 years old, and I was a three-time loser. And I was aware that I had this second problem, and I didn't know what to do about it. And I was hurting, and I was afraid, because I was afraid if I got emotionally involved, I was going to end up drunk again. I had watched a lot of people, both men and women, get drunk behind this. And I didn't know what to do, but now my mind was turned on, and I was thinking. And it lit up. I come up with an idea. Now, when we're teaching our babies, we teach them the same things that we've been taught. You know, that's what we know. And I was teaching these babies, get a good basic program. Don't get emotionally involved your first year. And then I changed it just a little. But if you need to get laid, that's all right. Now, what I had in mind was that they could go out and do these things, and if it worked for them, they could come back and tell me how, and I'd be all right. Nobody's yet come back and told me how, including you guys. I've had the privilege of holding some of you in my arms since my husband is an alcoholic, and some of you have asked me to sit in on some of the conversations you've had, and I find out that men cry too, and they hurt the same as we do, gals. They don't walk away scot-free. And I began to understand this. And anyway, I figured I'd better do something. And I didn't know exactly what to do. But I remembered somewhere back in my childhood when I was attending church, either reading somewhere in the Bible or hearing about it, somebody discussing it. And it went something like this. And God was talking, and it was in red. And it said, I have created man in my image, and for man I have created woman, and woman is to follow man. I thought, well, now I've followed three of you son of a guns, and look where I've ended up at. The nut house and Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Something was wrong somewhere, and I didn't quite know where it was. So I started going back through this other big book, and sure enough, one day I found it in there. And it said what I thought it said. I have created man in my image, and for man I have made woman. And woman is to follow man, and man follows God. You see, I had never finished reading the instructions. Never finished reading them. Now, when I got into this book, one of the first things that it told me was that a lack of power was my dilemma, and to find this power was exactly what this book was all about. It says, we have written a book which we believe to be moral as well as spiritual. Now, I don't know what that would tell you, but this is what it told me. I don't believe that my drunkenness was a moral issue. I believe that my sobriety is. Now, when I talk up here today, I'm not talking about opinions. I'm sharing with you my experiences. And I'm sharing with you what I have learned out of this book here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sharing with you how I have applied it, how I've applied it to my daily life. I don't know how it's going to work for you or how you're going to have to apply it. But I do know this. You're going to have to apply it. Reading it will help you to learn. Memorizing it will be just that. You can go in meetings and you can spout it off, you know, and sound good. But you're going to have to live it. It says it's not a theory. We have to put it into action and bring it into our daily lives if it's going to work for us. If it's going to work for us. It talks about a spiritual way of life. Now, I don't know what that means to you, but I can tell you what it meant to me. My sponsor told me to keep it simple when I got here. And so for me, at the time when I got here, the connotation that I brought into my life as spiritual was simply becoming a better person. And when I walked through the doors to you and I put aside that alcohol, I was on a spiritual path from that point on. I was no longer drinking, and that in itself was a great improvement, believe me, from the kind of a drunken woman I was. And from there, the spiritual path, to me, is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you will take those steps, and as you begin to work them, if you are like me, you will find that more and more, as you bring them into your life and use them, good things will begin to happen. Now, that's not to say that you're going to walk in here and float on a cloud forever after, but it means you're going to learn how to live life without alcohol. I could no longer go over my problems or go under them or go around them. Through you, through this big book, I learned to walk through these things without picking up a drink. And again, because I didn't have the anesthetic, if you will. I learned how to begin to work with some of these problems, cope with them, if you will, correct as I went along, because that's what the book talks about, correcting our lives, making this 180-degree turn, taking this inventory so we know what we've been doing wrong, the exact nature of my wrongs, not the results of them. This book says that we have found, not only have we got a common problem, we've got a common solution. Now, this common solution is a spiritual way of life, like it or not. This book tells me that that's my only salvation. It says I can go through insanity or death or lead a spiritual way of life. Now, who else but an alcoholic is going to sit there and ponder what the hell he wants to do? You know. Huh. I'm so glad I made the right decision. But it's not been easy. Every once in a while, you know, it starts working again. I start thinking. This chapter in here, it says into action. It doesn't say into thinking. I didn't know that. Well, when I stopped thinking so much and began to get a little action behind me, you know, it began to work for me. Now, as I told you about this secondary problem again, that's on page 69. When you turn that page over, it's got the solution on it. There's always the solution to every problem. And on page 70, for any of you, those of you who may have that problem, it says in there on page 70, if we are truly sorry for what we have done and have asked God to take us to better things, we believe we will have been forgiven and will have learned our lesson. But if we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our experiences. Pretty damn strong words, if you ask me. I mean, they don't beat around the bush in this book. You know, they come right out and tell you exactly what they're thinking. You can't mistake what they're telling you to do, not if you read it. They use words like exactly, precisely. No room for the fertile imagination of an alcoholic to wander around in at all, you know. God. Well, I begin to understand a little bit more about what they were talking about here. Now, I had been watching some of the other people on this program and the things they were doing, you know. And when I found out that what I had been doing after I took this inventory and I looked back over these first three husbands that I had and why I had chosen them, I began to understand a little bit more about what the book was telling me and why I had so much trouble in that area. And you men might think about this too. I picked the kind of a man who had a lot of charm, polish, and prestige. Right, girls? Good looking. Fun loving. Woman chasing. Party going, and I married them. Because you see, when they married me, they were supposed to become home-loving, faithful, loyal husbands, because they had a lot of potential. Right, guys? How many times have I heard that story? And you guys do it. Oh, I've seen you do it. These young Virgin Marys walking this program. And you can't hardly wait. Because you see, when you girls get here, I don't care where you come from, you're a virgin. I'm not lying. We get a second chance at life. At least with these guys. You see, they somehow have the mistaken idea that they want to be the first one. Little realizing that what they should want to be is the last one. Right? I'd like to say that you guys are the only ones that are like that, but you aren't. All these dirty old women sitting around here, they're waiting for the same thing when you guys get here. They can't hardly wait. But anyway, as I began to understand where my problems were beginning to stem from, and had been stemming from, when that other book talked about man following God, you see, I had never chosen a man who followed God. It had simply never occurred to me. How many times in this program after you get sober, you know, you hear these things like the light bulb goes on and you say, darn, I never thought about that. You know, simply, you know, when the first question I asked when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was in September of 65. And I was sitting in this women's stag meeting and I said, you know, I really don't know what to do. Christmas is coming up. And we always drink pink champagne at Christmas. And several gals raised their hand, and I got answers like, well, honey, why don't you just stay in bed until they drink it up, you know. And somebody else said, well, why don't you have them get you a bottle of that non-alcoholic champagne? And then some wise woman said, honey, just don't drink it. It never occurred to me. This was the wisdom I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm back to this problem, you know, and I didn't know exactly what to do about it. And as I said, when I found out what it was I had been doing wrong, I began to understand what it says on page 62 when it's talking to us and it says, our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-willed run riot. Though he usually doesn't think so. Above all, we alcoholics must get rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. Pretty strong, straightforward words. Very simple. Very, very simple. I begin to understand. God, begin to understand. Now, what do I do? For the first time in my life, I begin to look at a man as a human being. And instead of spending all of my time looking at the outside, I begin to look at the inside. And I met my husband on this program. For any of you who are still single, they're around. I think what my husband said about me was, he found a rose in a garbage dump. Now, where I was hanging out at was the Allenette. Said I was a dingy one, but I was pretty good, Rose. But anyway, I met him. I was 6 years sober by this time. And I began to look at the inside. And I found out that it was very important for me to not go to bed with him first and to find out if I liked him. God, that never occurred to me either. liked him. Stay out of bed long enough to find out if you like him, because go to bed first, you know, you're lost. You're lost. Then I found out that I really respected this man. And that he walks a path, a spiritual path, this program talks about. He doesn't just talk about it, he lives it. And I fell in love with him, and we got married. And then it seemed like if it could go wrong, it did go wrong. We were married in August. And just before Christmas of that year, he was in a car accident and was almost killed. And shortly after that, before he was even back upon his feet yet, his mother passed away and we buried her. And right after that, I was in a car accident. And I had just gotten out of the hospital on Saturday. And they called me and told me that my mother had had a stroke. Mother lived long enough to celebrate her 62nd natal birthday. And 3 days before she died, she celebrated her 5th Alcoholics Anonymous birthday. As I said, this book I have is my mama's. Now, I always carried my bottle with me. Why not my book? Huh? There was one part of the book. You see, I had been taught before I pick up the first drink to come to you, to call you on the phone. And you see, that's the reason I had this emergency page. Because when I'm upset, I'm totally unbalanced. Totally unbalanced. Whatever the problem is, if I'm upset, I'm unbalanced. And I cannot think. And I got my book out. And I started down the list of numbers. Now, we all know we have a lot of names, because that's what they tell you when you come here. You know, get a lot of names and a lot of numbers. And I started out on this list, and I called, and the first thing that happened was the line was busy. So I called another number. There was nobody at home. So I called another number. They were just on their way out the door. And I just kept on going down the page. Well, hell, by the time I got to the end of the page, I'd forgotten why I called, you know. But it worked, you see. What difference does it make why it works or how it works? It works. And that's the whole story of this book. It works. Now, I found a lot of pain on this program, as you've heard all through my talk. I didn't come in here and get sober and just live happily ever after. You know, I came on this program and I was up and I was down and I was sidewise and I was every which way when I got here and since being here. And sometimes there was a little bit of balance. But it has always worked. I use it into my daily life. There was another thing that was very important to me in my sobriety, too. And there is a line in this book that I've used, a couple of lines. And it says, just to the extent that we do as we think God would have us, and then humbly rely upon Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? And you see, that tells me that there was going to be calamity in my life. Because, you know, that's all a part of life. But it also tells me that if I'm using this program and I am following this spiritual path, that I'm going to get enough peace of mind to live through it. Sometimes it has just been barely enough, but it's always been enough. You know, and it's held me in good stead for almost 19 years now. I'd like to tell you again, you know, that I've been happy all the time, but again, I have not. I called my first beginning years, and I'm talking about the first 5 to 7 years, I called them the agony and the ecstasy. Hell, I was either way up there or way down there, you know. And once in a while, there was a little bit of that in between. So there's been a lot of pain and a lot of sorrow, a lot of joys and a lot of happiness. And in closing today, I want to wish for each and every one of you all of the pain, all of the happiness, all of the sorrow, and all of the joys that I have walked through. Because you see, these things are life. And today I am living life. And life to me is Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Beverly.